Susan Burton was locked up 6 times. And after a long road to recovery, she spent the last 20 years helping other incarcerated women reenter society.
I think the freedom to be able to access what you need and you being the person who recognizes and realizes that and goes after it, it's just real important for any and all of our development.
And you may have heard of a little musical called Hamilton. This fall, Lin-Manuel Miranda is opening a new exhibition in Chicago that focuses on the history of the real-life Alexander Hamilton. We'll hear about that from Chicago Tribune theater critic Chris Jones.
What they're going to be able to do that no other museum has really been able to do is integrate sort of an exhibition on American history with the biggest hit show of the, you know, last 100 years.
That's all coming up on this encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The United States incarcerated more than 2.2 million people behind bars, according to the latest government data. It's more than any other country in the world. And since 1980, the incarceration rate for women has increased 700%. Most of these women are imprisoned for nonviolent offenses, and when they're released, the challenge is staying out. We also know that in the state of Illinois, nearly half of all incarcerated people are back behind bars within 3 years of being released. But among the women one California nonprofit works with, in 2015, 96% of those women stayed out of prison. That's a 4% recidivism rate. The nonprofit is called A New Way of Life, and they say they've been able to help these California women with successful reentry at about half the cost it took to incarcerate them. Susan Burton is the founder of A New Way of Life. She's also the author of Becoming Ms. Burton, which chronicles her own extraordinary life story from incarceration to creating a new way of life. I should note to our audience, her story does include sexual abuse, so this conversation may not be appropriate for all of our listeners. I spoke with Ms. Burton back in May when she visited with the University of Illinois Education Justice Project. Ms. Burton, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I say extraordinary because I think many people, upon hearing the details of your life, would indeed say that you have had such an extraordinary life and you've endured so much. And you talk about this in your book that just came out last year, your years of sexual abuse that started when you were 4. You gave birth to your first child at 14, and that was after you were raped. I can't imagine how hard it was for you to write the story of your childhood and share these stories publicly. What motivated you to write this book?
The story, I believe that the story of who the women are that are incarcerated, it needed to be told. When we talk about mass incarceration and those 2.3 million people, we hardly ever think about the women. And this story, I felt, would raise a conversation around the women that we are incarcerating. And while I put my story out there front and center, I received so much communication from women saying, when I read your book, I read my story. So over 70% of women incarcerated have experienced sexual abuse, domestic violence, molestation as a child. So although I tell the story through the lens of my life, we're talking about the thousands and the hundreds of thousands of women across this country also that are incarcerated.
And to that point, to your story, one of the things that really struck me was that as you had decades of this abuse that happened to you that started when you were very young and continued throughout your preteen and teen years, no one ever said to you until decades later that this wasn't your fault.
Yeah. Actually, 4 decades later, I was able to access therapy. And through the therapy sessions, I began to understand that it was not my fault. And the because earlier on, I talk in the book about my auntie blaming me and calling me names when she discovered what her boyfriend was doing to me. And I took that in and I wore it and I bared the burden of being abused, wearing it as if it was my fault. So, yeah, years later, I accessed resources that should have been and could have been available to me much earlier. There were so many times that there was space for something or someone to intercede to help me navigate what was happening in my life. But nothing intercede until my response to the trauma was criminalized. And that's what I see all across America. The response to poor women's trauma becoming criminalized when they use drugs to medicate it or alcohol to medicate it. And as I was in a prison here yesterday, and as I was talking about how we navigate trauma in our lives, there was a lot of head nods going on in the audience. So, you know, I know that what I'm saying is the experience of other women.
My guest is Susan Burton. She's the founder of A New Way of Life, the nonprofit that we are going to be talking about in a minute that she started. She's also the author of Becoming Ms. Burton. So, Ms. Burton, you were in and out of jail 6 different times. What do you think finally made the difference for you not to go back in?
What finally made the difference for me not to go back to prison is that I received help. I received help in a upscale community on the beach in Santa Monica, where I was able to deal with the trauma of the past. I joined AA's 12-step program, and I began to heal and get better. But the deal breaker for me was receiving community supports and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the difference. And that's also what propelled me to look at my community and the needs of the community and create A New Way of Life Reentry Project. And, you know, A New Way of Life to date has helped over 1,000 women come back into the community, helped women, 300 women to reunite with their children. So,
and I wanted to ask you about some of those stories of, as you said in the book, not just your story, but many of the women that you talk about. And I wanted, there's a woman that you start the book with, and it's her name is Ingrid.
Yes.
And she received a 3-year prison sentence for leaving her sleeping baby in a car. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so Ingrid took her toddler on her hip with her into the store and left her newborn in the car seat in the car while she ran into a General Dollar store and bought Pampers and baby formula. She wasn't gone any more than 10 minutes, maybe 8 minutes, and she returned to the car and the police was there. And she was arrested for child endangerment, even though the baby was unharmed, and she was sentenced to 3 years in prison. And my thought around that is that, you know, had Ingrid had been a person of means, had Ingrid been in a different neighborhood, had Ingrid not been black, would she have been given 3 years in prison, or would she have been sent to therapy classes, parenting classes, and given supports to be, to understand the mistake that she made? And I see this over and over again. One of the other things that I compared was when I was in Santa Monica at this pretty exclusive recovery place, I saw that people in Santa Monica weren't punished, weren't criminalized, and weren't caged and chained for drug use. They were given help. And I'm like, why is there such a different approach in poor communities across America? My community was South LA. And so I see that as part of the unjust system that we have here in this nation, that people of means get other treatment from poor people. So our prisons are filled with poor people across America.
And you also, to that point, you share a story of another woman named Lisa James, and the $40,000 in debt that she accumulated while she was in prison because she had to pay child support back when she came out of prison because she was separated from her children. How common are debts like that for mothers who go into prison?
They're common for mothers. They're common for fathers, and they're common for mothers. So you are pretty much a prisoner or a ward of the state, and you're expected to be able to pay child support while you're a ward of the state. And these debts just pile up and pile up and pile up. So when a person is released, not only do they have these 48,000 barriers that's been documented by the American Bar Association, they also have this big weight of a debt. So if they are able to get a job, their paychecks are confiscated. And I need to tell you that while people are incarcerated, they make like 10 cents an hour, 8 cents an hour. A high-paying job inside of a institution is a dollar an hour. That's the executive level pay. And how do you pay child support with those types of wages? So it's a really a system. Our criminal justice system is a system that we really need to look closely and dismantle much of what it has done and is doing to people.
My guest is Susan Burton. We're talking about her story and the women that she has worked with in reentry through A New Way of Life. Ms. Burton, I wonder if you can share a little bit about A New Way of Life. And you just talked about so many obstacles that are in place for and let's just talk about women, because I think we oftentimes, I think when we have this conversation, we talk about men who are returning citizens as opposed to women.
Yes.
Can you give us an example of some of the specific challenges and the ways that you have approached this with A New Way of Life with the women that you're helping in California?
Yeah. So A New Way of Life consists of five single family homes throughout the community of South L.A. And it's a place that women can be released to or come to after they spend some time incarcerated. A place there where they can feel welcomed, valuable, and a part of the community. While we have structure there, we also have a lot of resources from job. We have a job developer there on site. We have financial classes. We have an attorney to help women get their children back. It's two women to each bedroom. The morning starts with morning meditation and goal setting, and there's a 10 o'clock curfew. We engage in community events. We engage in political events, and we engage in 12-step meetings, and it's a place where people can land, not feel judged, feel welcomed, and have the opportunity to rebuild their lives, whatever that might be, whether it's going to get a job, going to school, or going to drug treatment, or whatever their dreams or needs may be.
What kind of emotional support do you think is most important for people who have been incarcerated?
It depends on the individual, and we take an individualized approach. We also have a therapist on staff that each woman can get a schedule with the therapist, whether it's once a week, once a month, every 2 weeks, whatever her need and schedule is. I think the freedom to be able to access what you need, and you being the person who recognizes and realizes that and goes after it, it's just real important for any and all of our development.
And do you think, how important is it also to have mothers reunited with their children? What kind of difference do you think that makes in terms of recidivism?
I mean, it's really important. children ache for their mother, and mothers ache to be responsible and good parents for their children. So we have child reunification services on site. We actually have an attorney to help our residents walk through the process of reuniting with children. And children can be a grounder, or are a grounder for women to stay crime free, to be good parents, to provide for their children, and look to create a home after some time at a new way of life. So it's really, really important. As you know, my 5-year-old son was killed by an LAPD detective. And that sent me just reeling into alcoholism and addiction, which got me incarcerated. So I know how important it is to have your child, to be able to parent your child. So, yeah.
I'm so sorry for your loss. Thank you for sharing that with us. I want to pick up this conversation. We have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Susan Burton about her story and these women, and a conversation about incarceration in America. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been hearing a conversation from earlier this year with Susan Burton. Ms. Burton, I wanted to ask you, your work started in California, but you're working across the country, and you're here in Illinois, where we have the largest jail in the country. That's Cook County, which, by the way, Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart has described as the country's also largest mental health facility. What do you think of how our prison system in Illinois works? How do you think it compares to other states?
So I think this country, Chicago, Illinois included, has a real problem to its approach to creating safe and thriving communities. There is sort of like the, what do we have here, the disease of incarceration. So many individuals. Last month, I was at Cook County Jail, and I went in and did a book reading with the women there. And I went yesterday with Rebecca Ginsburg to Decatur, I think it was.
The Decatur Women's Prison.
The Decatur mm-hmm. Women's Prison, and sat down and did a book reading with those women also. I think that we could really shift resources in a way to create what really makes communities safe, and that would be really good schools. That would be parks, arts, recreation for our communities. That would be housing. That would be jobs. That would be mental health services. So what is this country doing? What is Illinois doing caging people because they're mentally ill? Something's really wrong with that. I mean, it's like morally wrong, and medically wrong. You know, why are we incarcerating people for substance abuse? Why aren't we treating them and supporting them to understand how they can grow to be the best people that they can be without using drugs. You know, what is at the core of their drug use? These are the things that we could get at that really makes our communities truly safe.
And when you just talk about this, the cost of this is, I think, an important part of the conversation. On average, how much does it cost to incarcerate someone in this country?
So on average, it's between $60,000, $75,000 a year for a youth. It can go up to $200,000 per year. So at A New Way of Life, it takes $16,000 for a woman to live in one of our homes for a year. And after that year, she's really standing strong in her community. She's obeying our laws. She's working. She's going to school. She's, you know, creating a business. You know, if I had a few women to create baking business and jewelry making business and different things, but they're a whole different person. After a person is released after a year of incarceration, they are traumatized and troubled. And that's why there needs to be support for people as they walk out of the prisons back to our community. It can make all the difference in the world in the way in which they develop and become contributing, law-abiding members of our community.
And when we think about that, when you look at the last year and a half in our country, and I'm thinking in particular of changes from President Obama to President Trump. Certainly President Obama had a lot of different reforms that he announced for our criminal justice system. What do you think has changed as far as our federal government's philosophy for the criminal justice system? How much a difference do you think the president makes?
The president makes a huge difference. So we have this growth of detention centers, which is just another form of mass incarceration. We have the dismantling of federal halfway houses, which leaves people falling out of the federal system without supports to be reintegrated back into the community. And that was one of the federal system's kind of a signature pieces that they did for people who were being released from federal prisons, was to give them 9 months of halfway houses before they're actually released, which the state and the county does not do. So it's more dismantling of this social safety net and more building of places for incarceration, be it the private prison, detention centers.
My guest is Susan Burton. Her story is told through a book that came out recently last year called Becoming Miss Burton. She's the founder of A New Way of Life. We're talking about her reentry program. If you would like to join us, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Alita just tweeted, thank you for giving Miss Burton's work airtime. As Oprah has pointed out, instead of what's wrong with you, we should be asking what happened to you and what help do you need? Thanks for that comment, Alita. Ms. Burton, do you think that, did anyone ask you that? When did someone first ask you that question?
I think the first light of relief that I got was walking through a hall in a prison when I told my teacher there in that prison some of the things that had happened to me as a child and as a young lady. And her response to me was not to worry about passing her class.
And she was a really tough lady.
She was a tough teacher.
She
was famous for flunking her whole class. And if you flunked this class, you couldn't get released. And it might take you 8 months to come back around to her class. So she was a terror of the yard. And when she said that to me, it's like I got permission to really begin to examine that something really, really went wrong in my life. And that's when I began to sort of look at and tear apart and go back and examine some of my experiences. Because up to that point, you know, you're just navigating trauma. You're just trying to get through one day to the next with as less harm as possible.
And to that point, I wanted to just ask you one more question about your personal story. You always had one person who was trying to encourage you to get out of the life that you were in, and he was your bail bondsman, George. Can you tell me about what he would say to you?
Yeah, he would tell me, you know, you're really, really smart. You could go back to school. You could. He tried to get me to be a one of the people who certifies letters. And he would encourage me and tell me that I was such a good person and that, you know, my life needed to change. And while he was always there encouraging me, he was the one person that I guess always stood by me. He's my friend now and he's retired. He's no longer a bail bondsman. And we were talking a couple of weeks ago about the bail industry and how horrendous it is, and how it people are exploited through it. And he was telling me about when that began to take shape and what law enforcement was doing.
Because it wasn't always this way.
It wasn't always this way. The exploitive nature and the high bills and the way people are held now is just out of control.
So in Illinois, there are certain there's some changes that have just taken effect in terms of bail reform in the system, and particularly when it comes to people who can't afford to pay bail and are waiting trial and are sitting in prison. How much do you think it's up to states or municipalities to lead the way in changing the way that we our incarceration system?
Yeah, so it's really up to states, but it's also up to community. It's also up to us to shift our mind to thinking about not punishing people and not retribution, but how do we make everybody whole? What do they need? So what about restorative justice practices instead of punitive responses to social problems like crime? How do we shift to that? How better off would we be as a state? Yes, it is up to states to do this, but it's also up to community. We can't shift all the responsibility to the state. We need to be the example of what we want to see and push our states to actually reflect that.
And so when you say that, what particularly are you thinking about? Are you thinking about the initiatives that you were involved with personally? And I'm thinking about the Ban the Box initiative that originated, I believe, in California.
Yeah, like Ban the Box right here in Champaign on the university application. There's a box that says, have you ever been convicted? Why is that box on the university application? It needs to be taken off. And this community needs to pressure the university to remove that and allow people passage to higher education. That can only help the outcome of any individual. So that's one way there around banning the box on the university application.
And that box is a question about whether or not you've been convicted, whether or not you have a criminal record. How much does that make a difference in someone's life after they come out of prison?
It makes a huge difference because we know from research that the application that's checked with the box is the application that does not get reviewed. It doesn't matter that you went back to school and you have skills in this area and that you have expertise and you have experience. Once you check the box, employers out there know this and people know this, that application usually is passed over unless you have a friend in the place, unless you know someone that knows someone that can help you out there.
And I wonder what you think of some research that I've seen recently about that looks at states that have now initiated these ban the box methods. So they've removed this, but then there's been some research that shows then that creates an even wider effect of discrimination against people who are particularly African American.
Right. There's a study that came out that said a white man with a criminal record is more apt to got the job versus a black man without a criminal record with the same level of skill set. So, you know, we have a big problem, and we have racism is a big problem in America. I've been across the waters to Lisbon, to Portugal, to Norway, to Finland, and I looked at what they do there, and it's so different from what we do here in America, but they have a pretty homogeneous population. Big problem, racism in America.
Well, and I wanted to just ask you about, to that point, you thank Michelle Alexander for her role in your life. And for our audience who don't know her, she's an academic, longstanding work in legal work as well as academic work in the area of our incarcerated system, the author of The New Jim Crow. How did reading her book change your life?
So let me say, Michelle is my heroine. She's a warrior. She's a strong woman who tells the truth just like it is. And I really admire her. But when I read The New Jim Crow, there was a level of forgiveness. You know, there's layers of things that you do to help yourself, like the onion peeling, right? There was a level of forgiveness that I had for myself and for my community members that really went deep, because it explained what had happened in our lives and in our community in a way that the policies, the laws, the manipulation that had been put in place through many administrations, many presidential administrations. And I knew firsthand the impact of that bad public policy, the bad communication strategies that they implemented to tear communities apart and create the us-them type of mentality and attitude. So the level of forgiveness that I felt for myself and for my community really strengthened my resolve to continue to dig in deep and create a way for women who had been criminalized to come back into their communities and pick up their beds and walk.
And so you wrote that in your book, right? That jail didn't help you with your addiction. What helped was having this support system, having education and hard work and dedication and realizing that your life had value. Do you think it's possible to have that in our prison system now?
So I think we have leaned so far toward incarceration and prisons that we've really gotten a warped sort of view of what's necessary. I believe that we should be shifting money out of prisons into communities to make communities stronger, to make people stronger, to create the type of safety that will really have us thrive, have people safe and people not pushed to the edge, people not breaking down mentally because of all the pressures and inability to meet those pressures. I think we spend far too much on police and prisons and not enough investing in schools and communities.
That's Susan Burton. She's the author of Becoming Ms. Burton, founder of A New Way of Life. Thank you for being with me. I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for the time I spent talking with you today.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Just to wait.
It's been nearly 3 years since Hamilton, the musical, first opened on Broadway, and since then it's spread to the UK. But of course, we remember that Chicago was the first city that Hamilton expanded to outside of New York. But the interest hasn't waned, and now Chicago is getting its own exclusive exhibition opening on Northerly Island this fall. Hamilton, the exhibition, is being billed as a one-of-a-kind interactive look at the story of America's founding, all told from this perspective of Alexander Hamilton. Chris Jones is a theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. He reported on this for the paper and joins us now. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the 21st.
How are you? Nice to talk to you.
Yes. Yeah, so, Hamilton, the exhibition. Because who could have predicted that Hamilton is still, maybe not as incredibly popular as it was, but certainly it hasn't really waned that much interest in the musical or even now Alexander Hamilton.
Well, one of the reasons it's not waned that much is that they're very, very good at keeping it in everybody's, keeping attention on the show, whether it's sort of dropping new recordings or, you know, mixtapes or in this case, an exhibition. So, I mean, Lin-Manuel Miranda has just been incredibly adept at, you know, rather than writing a new show, he's just continued to sort of, I guess you'd say promote, but also to just kind of extend the brand of Hamilton itself.
And there has really been, and you talked to him about this, I think he's surprised at the level of interest that people have in the actual historical person of Alexander Hamilton.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, whenever people ask me, why is this show the way it is? You know, why is there this level of demand? What the heck, you know? And it is an enormous level of demand, as you say. And I think in part it's because it's a substantial piece of art. And what I mean by that is it's not even Harry Potter or Frozen. It's about America. It's about the founding of the nation. It has a historical importance, and people see it as crucial, particularly for young people, for education. So he's been able to get people all the way up to President Obama, of course, and the First Lady, effectively promoting the show for him. And so I think this is in some ways an acknowledgement of that and an attempt to kind of create, you know, a new experience for Hamilton fans. And essentially, from what I can understand, and I've seen renderings of pretty much of everything that they're going to do. So the deal is there's a tent-like structure, whether it's a tent might not be quite the right word, a temporary structure anyway, that's going to be on Northerly Island in Chicago, which is right out in the lake. Now, it doesn't open till November, so it's going to be really cold if you go out there in the first several weeks. So that's interesting, but that's a whole other issue. And then you're going to go there, you're going to pay your $35 or thereabouts, and you're going to walk through a kind of interactive exhibit, really all about Hamilton, the man, Alexander, that is, and all about the founding of this nation. And the thing that will make it different, of course, and the reason everybody will go, is that Lin-Manuel Miranda, maybe in hologram form or verbal form, will be your guide. And the exhibit obviously has access to the show. So, for example, the songs will be playing as part of your tour. The lyrics will be on the walls of the exhibit. So what they're going to be able to do that no other museum has really been able to do is integrate, you know, sort of an exhibition on American history with the biggest hit show of the, you know, last 100 years. So that's basically what's going on.
And Chris, to your point, Hamilton the musical is a work of art. How much of this exhibition is about then the actual history, the actual facts of Alexander Hamilton's life?
Well, I think the exhibition is entirely about the facts of Alexander Hamilton's life. However, it is presented through a theatrical lens. So when they explained it all to me, there's a lot of very interesting kind of theatrical things you're going to be able to do. There's going to be a recreation of the room where it happened. There's going to be they're going to give people a sense of what happened when Hamilton moved uptown. You know, after the death of his kid, there's a famous song in the musical where he goes uptown. It's quiet uptown, if you remember that song. And that, of course, back in the day, that was a trek into the, even though they were moving to essentially Upper Manhattan, it was a trek to into the rural world, if you like. So they're going to recreate that. There's going to be an ability to talk about what kind of presidency America should have now as it did then. So it's very much about the guy. I don't think that there's nothing in the exhibit on like how they made the show, or it's not like that. It's not a backstory to Hamilton the show. But it's all done by theater people, so it's going to be very immersive. And it's also very expensive. Like, I think they're spending, they wouldn't say exactly, but I think probably $10-15 million on this exhibit. So, I mean, it's not going to be, you know, knocking around in a tent with a few display cases, if you know what I mean. It's going to be a lot more than that.
And I'm just thinking about the young people, and I'm thinking in particular of my nieces and nephews. My 6-year-old niece can do the entire Skylar Sisters rap. So I think that they're for children, and I'm thinking about children who love Hamilton, the musical. It sounds like a really interesting opportunity to present history in a way that hasn't been done before. And I suppose if someone could do that here, it would be Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I don't think anything like this has ever quite been done in the same way, because most artworks or most shows, for example, are not, you know, you can't really have Frozen the exhibition, right? You could have an exhibition on how they made it, but they're not, there's not anything there at the end of the day. Whereas with Hamilton, you actually have, it's a bio musical, so you actually have this very important guy who is there really at the founding of American democracy. And the show has been highly successful in part because, you know, it's emphasized the fact that he was an immigrant. And, of course, it uses a very diverse cast. So you have the sense that this history is for everybody, and that the founding of America is an issue that everybody, you know, should be involved in. And so I think it really will, you know, have an enormous impact educationally. I mean, there is this question about how many people will go. Now, it's $35, which is more than it costs you to get in the Field Museum here, more than it costs you to get in the Met, I think. But it's still a lot less than going to the show, obviously.
And I did want to ask you about that cost. And I think particularly we know that musicals like Hamilton aren't affordable for a lot of people, although Lin-Manuel Miranda has really tried to get especially kids and public school students in front of this show. Yes. Do you think that that's also going to be a part of a component of this exhibition, is having school children there?
They said essentially their aim is to have school groups come in for free. So I think, you know, if you're, I think almost all the Chicago public schools will go. I'm sure a lot of the suburban schools will go. I suspect some of the downstate schools will go too. So I think a lot of people will get to see it for free as part of a school group. Now, if you go with your kids, then you probably are going to pay, I'm guessing, about $20 or $25 for the kids, you know, alongside your $35. So, I, you know, they have had a very, they've had a kind of Robin Hood policy at Hamilton where they've charged as much as they possibly can for the really good seats, and then they've given away some seats. But, you know, let's not fool ourselves. For most people, it's a major investment. Now, I do think, you know, if we'd been having this conversation a year ago, it was very expensive in Chicago. And I think now you can actually, particularly on a weeknight, particularly when the kids are not out of school, you actually can see Hamilton now for a lot less than you could a year ago, a lot less. And, you know, and I think, you know, particularly if you buy fairly late in the game, there's often a few seats available if you're go on a Tuesday night or Wednesday night where you're not paying an enormous amount of money. So it's not as insane as it was in Chicago because, of course, it's been here for a while now. And the show is every bit as good. It's the same guy playing Hamilton as when it opened. But it's still, I sometimes feel now that people think it's a bit worse than it is, if you know what I'm saying. And you can actually get to see it. It's cheaper here, in fact, way cheaper than it is in Washington, where it's just now landing, and the prices there are insane.
Or London. London's. Yeah. I mean, the prices in London are insane, too.
Insane, that's right.
Why Chicago for this exhibition? I mean, Hamilton is, in many ways, it's a New York story. It's a Washington story. Why is he opening this exhibition here?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think number one is that the show has, other than New York, the show has been here the longest. So that gives you, I think I calculated 1.5 to 1.7 million people have seen Hamilton in Chicago as we have this conversation right now. So that immediately is people who know the show. I would imagine a good percentage of those people would like to have another experience. So that gives them, you know, an audience that they can count on that they wouldn't have in a city that's not been exposed to the show. So that's number one reason. Number two is that you can't do this in New York because there's no space. So you can't, there's nowhere in Manhattan, to be honest, that you could do this because they want to stay. I think their hope in Chicago is they'd be here for 9 months, maybe a year. And they want to stay, and you can't, you know, you can't do this in Central Park. So the only place you can really do it in New York is New Jersey, and they didn't want to go to New Jersey. So I think Chicago has the benefit of the space that allows them to do it, because even the Cirque du Soleil really struggled to find a spot to put their tent in Manhattan. The land is just so expensive there. So Chicago, I think, made sense for that reason.
And I imagine, like the musical itself in Chicago, he's expecting a lot of visitors from outside Chicago to attend this exhibition.
Yeah, I mean, the show has been a major tourist draw, major. I mean, people come from all over the place. Now, that will dissipate a little bit because there's more road tours going out of Hamilton, particularly beginning in the fall. So at that point, there's going to be... you know, you're going to be able to see it in Wisconsin, for example, which you haven't been able to up till now. And the more productions there are, I think that does reduce demand in Chicago if people can see it, you know, in St. Louis, say, or around, you know, the people will have other choices. But, you know, it still remains the majority of people there are from out of town. And I think the exhibition will be a huge draw. I mean, it's starting right before Thanksgiving, so I would imagine it will be really crammed all the way through the end of the holidays. And then, you know, all the businesses in Chicago are pleased because tourism is really light in those cold months, you know, January, February, March. So to have a big new attraction like that is really good news for everybody. So there's a lot of people are like, great, we're going to have more people staying in the hotels and all of that. Now, whether this will really work out, you know, are people going to drive 5 and 6 hours to see what's basically a historical exhibit? And there's no actual artifacts either. You know, that's worth thinking about. There's no, you don't get to see any of his actual stuff. It's all just clever, you know,
holograms of Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Exactly. But, you know, in my experience, I got to say, anyone who's bet against Hamilton so far has been wrong. It just has an enormous level of pre-awareness, and it's just... Someone said to me a week ago or so, if anyone else was trying to do this on Northerly Island in the winter, they would fail because it's cold out there, it's icy, you know, I'm not quite clear where people are going to park. There's a lot of, you look at it, you go, really? That's not going to be easy. But it's Hamilton, people are just willing to do anything for Hamilton, it seems.
Chris Jones is the Chicago Tribune's theater critic. Chris, thanks for being with me. I appreciate
My
it.
My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. We're going to end with one of the most popular songs from Hamilton, The Room Where It Happens. Before we sign off for the week, on Monday's program, we're going to be talking about a couple of sensitive topics, money and marriage. The number of women who earn more than their husbands is still relatively small, but it's growing. And new research shows that this is something that both husband and wives aren't always comfortable with. Sometimes they even lie about it to the government. So, what about you listening? Are you a woman who makes more than her partner, or a husband whose wife makes more than him? How does what you make play into your relationship? Leave us a voicemail with your thoughts. Our phone number is 217-300-2121. Again, our hotline number is 217-300-2121. And we'll play that on Monday's program. You can also always email us. It's talk@21stshow.org. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps. You can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple. You just download it and set your home station. And then if you search for The 21st and follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. You can also get us wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. If you follow us, we live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, just go to our website, 21stShow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.